Welcome to the podcast of the Diane Rehm Show Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists joins Diane to discuss the week's top stories from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Dogpile.com. All of these search engines piled into one: Google, Yahoo, Live Search, and Ask.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto rejects President Musharraf's road to elections hours after her release from house arrest in Pakistan today. U.S. military leaders say Iraq's Shiite-dominated government is now the biggest obstacle to the U.S. effort there. And the U.S. and Iran each claim vindication with the release of a new U.N. report on Iran's nuclear program. Joining me to discuss these stories and more on the Friday News Roundup, David Sanger of the New York Times. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show, David.
Thank you.
Keith Richburg of the Washington Post. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And joining us for the first time at the News Roundup, Khalid Hassan of the Friday Times and Daily Times of Pakistan. Thank you for coming in this
Thank
morning.
Thank you.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, it's 9 p.m. in Pakistan. A lot has happened there today. Khalid Hassan, tell us what's going on.
Well, what is going on is nothing good is going on, really, because the country continues to be under martial law, which has been euphemistically being called a state of emergency. There are no fundamental rights. Thousands are in jail. Practically every civil society leader that I can think of and I know is in jail. There is absolutely no movement on the ground. You cannot take out a procession. You cannot stage any public protest. And the television channels have been blacked out. Two have been given permission to operate. I think that happened yesterday, but there are conditionalities. You won't show this, you won't say that. So there is censorship. And the press is being, the print media is being monitored by government censors, and they are in a state of fear, I would say. And it's a country under siege. And, Mr. Negroponte has arrived in Islamabad today. The U.S. continues to back Musharraf because all the eggs of the Bush administration had been placed in his basket, and they're hoping that he can still swing it. But the general opinion is that he cannot survive. It's a matter of time.
David Sanger, John Negroponte, who is, of course, the United States Deputy Secretary of State, arriving today in Pakistan, what is he hoping to do?
The effort, Susan, is to convey a sort of double-edged message to Musharraf, because Khalid just said to you, the U.S. position until now has always been to back Musharraf no matter what. I get the sense, just from people I talk to in the White House and the State Department, that they now have reluctantly come to the conclusion that they may be riding a really slow horse to the finish line out here. And I think they're debating whether or not they leap off to another one. But they can't quite bring themselves to do it. And the reason is complex. The first is that General Musharraf, while he may be making a mockery of the early statements the administration had about how he was a general committed to democracy, is at least a general we know. And he's sitting on something between 50 to 115 nuclear weapons. It's fine by the administration if another general takes over and they have the sense that the army, which is the strongest institution in the country, is still in control of those weapons. But if Musharraf's departure leads to a free-for-all, then they're very worried. So they don't really want to begin to back away from him until they understand who's next.
Is it clear who the United States might prefer, Keith Richburg?
Well, I think not. And I think, you know, I think my colleagues have summed it up pretty nicely. I think they see that backing Musharraf, as they have done all this time. It's been a Musharraf policy, not a Pakistan policy. They see that's now unraveling. You know, you see these things all the time, the last days of Marcos in the Philippines, the last days of Suharto in Indonesia. You can tell when the rug is being pulled out from under a regime, and there's always this effort to try to stage manage the exit and figure out what's coming next. In this case, you have a democratic opposition. What they would have liked, had it worked, had this not happened, was to get Benazir Bhutto in as the democratic face on what would be essentially still a Musharraf regime. Now that she's basically saying she's not playing ball, I think they really are up in the air about what to do about this now. I think everybody recognizes the Pakistani military is going to be the dominant institution, so nothing's going to take over that doesn't have at least the support of the military, if not specifically another general. How this is all going to happen, I think nobody knows at this point, and that's where
the big
danger is.
May I say that this is a very, very cynical view, and I reject this. Number one, to say that the Pakistani nuclear weapons are not safe except with General Musharraf in charge is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, the fact is that Pakistan is an organized state, and nobody is going to sort of start lobbing these bombs at A, B, and C. Secondly, to think in terms of who is going to replace Musharraf, another general, the fact is that the people of Pakistan do not want military rule, and the United States must support the people of Pakistan. They must support the democratic urge. And there is an upsurge across the country. And unfortunately, they are still thinking and behaving in terms of one general replacing another. And even this here on this table, I hear the same sort of thoughts, you know, which is disillusioning to me.
Well, Benazir Bhutto released from house arrest today. Is she a possible agent of change here, do you think?
Well, someone may I say, will you please leave it to the democratic process? We don't know what a free and fair election will throw up. But the one thing is absolutely certain. As long as Musharraf is around, there can be no free and fair elections. He has to go.
Now, we've been waiting for parliamentary elections in Pakistan and not clear whether they're going to take place. David Sanger, what are the prospects for elections there now?
Well, President Musharraf says he's going to conduct elections, and he says he's going to conduct them on the schedule in January. This is a change from a few weeks ago when we were hearing that they could delay these elections for up to a year. But as Khalid has made clear, it's a little difficult to run free elections when all of the opposition leaders and all of the civil liberties groups and all that are sitting in jail. It really slows down campaigning a lot. Whether, you know, you could hold an election and it might not pass the laugh test. Let me just back up on what Khalid said before. I can't speak for Keith, but I don't think that we were necessarily taking a position, he and I, about how things should work out. We were trying to explain how the Bush administration views this. The Bush administration is caught between its rhetoric about wanting a very democratic Pakistan and it's the reality of what American interests are there. And America's got two strong interests there: control of the nuclear weapons and pursuit of al-Qaeda and the Taliban in the Northwest Territories. And that is the dilemma the administration finds itself in today.
On Monday, Diane's show in the first hour will be devoted to the issue of Pakistan, with a particular focus on that nuclear arsenal and whether it's safe or not, and depending on what might happen in terms of political
change.
What I
can't understand is this assumption by the U.S. administration that only a military government is capable of fighting terrorism or safeguarding nuclear weapons. I mean, this is a very questionable assumption. And it's wrong.
You're right. It is a questionable assumption because you've had a military government and they have not done a terribly good job in the Northwest Territories. And AQ Khan happened, the Pakistani scientist who helped arm Iran, Libya, and North Korea, happened while two successive military governments were in place.
That's right.
A remarkable story in the Washington Post this week, Keith Richburg, by Thomas Ricks, who has been a guest on this program. A story from Iraq saying senior military commanders there, American military commanders, now portray the intransigence of Iraq's Shiite-dominated government as the key threat facing the U.S. effort in Iraq, a more serious threat than al-Qaeda terrorists or Sunni insurgents. That is really, I think, a remarkable finding.
It is a remarkable finding, but it fits in a lot of other small pieces of the puzzle that we know. If you look in today's paper, and it's a very small story inside, but it shows that the number of improvised explosive devices is way down. It's down about one half of what it was before. The number of U.S. combat deaths is down. The number of Iraqi civilian deaths is down. Violence is down. The number of large-scale suicide attacks is significantly down. And so, you know, it was interesting to hear at this Democratic debate last night the question posed, you know, is the surge really working? And people have to say, well, actually, on the military side, it's working. But the surge was never supposed to be a military strategy. It was supposed to be giving the Iraqi government breathing time to make necessary reforms, to reach out to the Sunnis, de-Baathification, to allow some of the Ba'ath Party people to come back into the government, reversing that, the oil law, sharing revenues. None of these things has been done, and it doesn't look like anything is going to be done in the short term, at least. So that's why, whether the surge is working, the answer is yes. On a military level, it's doing exactly what it was planned to do. But what does it all mean?
David Sanger, what could happen to jumpstart the political process in Iraq that's been so disappointingly slow?
You know, the administration's been through two phases on this, Susan. Their initial thought was that if you jumpstarted the political process, this was 2 years ago, that would bring security about. They couldn't do it. Then they thought, well, look, if you can just bring about security, it will jumpstart the political process. And as Keith has just explained, that hasn't happened either. The fact of the matter is, they're fresh out of new ideas about what to do to bring in these different parts together. And it raises the question of, by what standard do we measure success in Iraq? I thought what was interesting about the debate yesterday, what's interesting what the administration people say is they all say the surge is working. And as Keith has pointed out, yeah, it's working in a military way. But then when you go back to the administration, you say, but look, here were the set of objectives you laid out for us before you invaded Iraq in early 2003. And you go through the list. There's sort of a long silence.
We've talked about holding elections in Pakistan. How about the prospect of holding provincial elections in Iraq? Could that be a possible approach, Khalid?
Well, I don't know. My own view is that unless the neighboring countries like Iran and Syria are involved in this situation, there can really be no peace in Iraq, and the situation is not going to improve.
Khalid Hassan is U.S. correspondent for the Friday Times and Daily Times of Lahore, Pakistan. And we're also joined by Keith Richburg from The Washington Post and David Sanger of The New York Times. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the situation in Iran. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. I'm joined in the studio by Khalid Hassan of the Friday Times and Daily Times of Pakistan, Keith Richburg from The Washington Post, David Sanger from The New York Times. Well, the UN's nuclear watchdog group has released a new report on Iran. What does it find, Keith?
Well, it's an interesting finding. It shows that on some aspects of their past program, the Iranians have indeed released information, but in relation to what their current program shows, that they aren't releasing as much as they should be releasing under the agreements. They're still enriching uranium. They've got something like 3,000 centrifuges in operation here. And while the American side, the State Department, has come out and said this shows we need now to go back with and get tougher sanctions from the Security Council, you're still, I believe, going to find the reluctant members of the Council, specifically Russia and China, coming back and saying, well, the report does show that there is some cooperation here, and it's too early or too premature to pull the plug on the process. So I think there's a little bit of something for everybody. It's only going to reinforce existing positions is the way I see it.
Well, in that case, what happens next, David?
Well, the U.S. has said that it is going to move to more severe sanctions, and that if it can't get the U.N. Security Council to go along with it, it will try to get the Europeans. It looks like they probably will get the British and the French, at least, especially under the new French government. What's going to happen with Germany is still a little bit up in the air. And then failing that, they can go to much more severe unilateral sanctions, but unilateral sanctions don't tend to be terribly effective because we don't have a whole lot of trade with Iran right now. The report has two things in it that I think are worth thinking ahead about. The first is that at the very end of the report, you have to get down into, you know, paragraph 33 before you get to this, there's a fascinating but elliptical discussion of the Iranian program to develop their next generation of centrifuge. These are centrifuges that they got from the same man we talked about in the earlier segment, AQ Khan from Pakistan. But they're called P2s, and they run at three or four times the speed of these old machines that the Iranians are running right now. If they could get them up and running, they would have a much greater, much faster capacity. The 3,000 centrifuges that Keith referred to are an important political and psychological barrier. If you can run 3,000 centrifuges for a year, fundamentally uninterrupted, and we don't know how well they can run them, you can make enough enriched uranium for one weapon in 1 year. That has been a point that the Israelis and the U.S. at other moments in this crisis have said we wouldn't allow the Iranians to reach. They're there.
And so how much concern is there in the region, Khalid, that because the Iranians are moving ahead in the U.S. view, and because the United States has said that's unacceptable, that the Bush administration might take some action before it leaves office, some military action.
That's the concern. People believe that that President Bush is going to invade Iran before he goes. He's not going to leave the Iranian problem, as it is called, for the next administration. And I think the North Korean success, which the U.S. has had on the nuclear question, shows us the way, which is that if you put pressure and mount the pressure and sort of use coercive means, it doesn't work. I think you have to negotiate with Iran, and you cannot do that if you keep a country under threat, constant threat.
You say people believe, you mean people in the region believe the yes. United States will invade Iran? Oh,
absolutely, yes.
Well, what do you think, Keith? Is that a realistic possibility?
Well, you know, again, I had a fascinating time watching this Democratic debate last night because people in the audience seem to believe that President Bush and Dick Cheney and the neocons are getting ready to invade Iran. And that was one of the questions posed to the candidates. How are you going to stop this? I mean, it seems now because of what happened with the invasion of Iraq and the use of proliferation and weapons of mass destruction as the main pretext for that, there is this general feeling out there among a lot of people that, you know, that the Iranian threat is being made more of a threat than it really is, that there's no particular need to rush into this, but that the administration does want to do something before it leaves office. And that feeling is out there.
Do you agree with that, David?
I think that there is a great difference between the Iranian situation and Iraq, and an even bigger difference between the Iranian situation and North Korea. And what happens in these debates is that we tend to sort of blend them all together. In Iran's case, this information is not based on U.S. intelligence. It's based on the International Atomic Energy Agency. The Iranians have let the inspectors in. And it is not a question that requires immediate action, because by even the worst-case estimates of the U.S. intelligence community and others, the Iranians are still a number of years, a couple of years away from a bomb, and maybe longer. So there is, as people in the State Department will often remind us, time for diplomacy. But we also have less leverage than we have in, say, cases like North Korea. The North Koreans are dirt poor, and they need trade. The Iranians are sitting on $100 a barrel oil. it's a very different scene, and it limits our economic leverage over the Iranians considerably.
The director of National Intelligence, Mike McConnell, said this week that the United States government is close to completing a new national intelligence estimate on Iran. This would be a classified document, a consensus opinion by the intelligence agencies about what's going on with Iran. Why is this being done now, Keith?
Well, these are periodic estimates that come out. I don't think there's any kind of motive in this in terms of the timing of it. But I think what you're going to see is kind of a broad ranged look at everything, including the activity of the Revolutionary Guards, their relationship with Hezbollah, their relationship in Iraq. You're going to see broad base, and I think that's where the fear element comes in, because let's face it, we're in a political season now, and everything is being seen as political. Even the vote to designate the Quds Force as a terrorist organization came back with political repercussions, in the political campaign going on. So, of course, anything seen as possibly setting up the stage or creating, a public atmosphere where it's okay to attack Iran is going to be seen as overtly political. But I don't think the timing of the report is anything
political. In fact, this report is late. This report has been 2 months away for the past year. Aren't you glad to know we're not the only ones who are always late turning things in?
This week we saw factional violence break out in the Gaza Strip. And yesterday, the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, called for an ouster of Hamas there. What's going on, Khalid?
And I think it's, the peace process has stalled, and the role which the U.S. was expected to play, it has stopped short of playing that. And I think it's really time to get down to a very serious effort to bring the two sides together and to, come to some kind of a living arrangement.
A serious effort by the United States,
yes.
You mean? Well, we do have this Middle East conference coming up in Annapolis. David Sanger, what are the expectations of what will happen there?
Well, Susan, one word that you used tells you why our expectations are being so lowered. Is it a conference, as you just said? I thought it was a conference until I was corrected by a senior member of the administration who told me that it was actually a meeting.
Well, I called it a conference because I was told it wasn't a summit, which, it had already been downgraded from what you might have hoped.
This is like one of those hurricanes, that starts off at hurricane force and ends up being like a small tropical storm. I suspect by the time we're done, we're at small tropical storm levels. Their concern is that a conference means that you have to agree in advance to a plan and an agenda and all of that. And there is debate within the administration about how heavily the U.S. should get out in front of this and whether this is the right time for an agreement. And part of the problem is whether or not Prime Minister Abbas just has the authority at this point to actually negotiate and pull something off that is meaningful. But the Bush administration is looking at it and saying, gee, we have 14, 15 months left. If we don't do it now, we're never going to get to it.
Well, you hear Condoleezza Rice talking about it, and she's convening this, not a summit, not a conference, maybe a meeting. But I think maybe the history of the U.S. effort in the Middle East has been that you really need presidents to get involved to actually achieve progress. It's such a difficult area. Do we see President Bush showing that kind of personal involvement?
No. I mean, look, this is a meeting of three incredibly weak Greek fragile governments coming together for a last-ditch throw of the ball with the 2 seconds left on the clock. I mean, this is a lame duck administration. It's got pretty much no public opinion standing above 30%. And, you've got Olmert, who's incredibly weak inside Israel. You got Abbas, who's weak. This is all happening. Look, Tony Blair, who was the major ally in the invasion of Iraq, was saying 3-4 years ago that was the time to really engage in the Arab-Israeli dispute and try to settle it as part of the whole package, including invading Iraq. And basically, he was ignored until very recently when, things in Iraq aren't going well. The negotiations with negotiations by the Europeans with the Iranians aren't going well. And so it seems like all of a sudden they're looking for some kind of a diplomatic victory to put this thing on the agenda. Nothing's going to happen in the next 14 months.
But I wonder if President Bush is a lame duck, so nothing will happen in the next 14 months. And then whoever the new president is will take some time to get kind of up to steam and decide what she or he wants to do in the Middle East. Will the Middle East just kind of wait for the United States to get its act together?
Well, let's hope not.
Well, what are the consequences of this? If what we're looking at is some extended period, more than a year, maybe even 2 years, U.S. not being playing as active a role as you might think.
Well, you know, I kind of saw this. I was there in the Middle East at the tail end of the Clinton administration, and you know, the same thing. The players on the ground are watching American politics, and you know, and at that time when you had Clinton calling sort of Arafat and Ehud Barak in and trying to kind of race to an agreement. I mean, everybody knew that this president was going to be gone. So how do we know that agreements made now are going to be honored? People are kind of hedging their bets in the region to see who the next president is, how much pressure they might apply to one side or the other. I mean, they're not stupid over there. They know that the whole process is going to be changing. And it requires concessions on both sides. And, you know, there's no way the Palestinians are going to go and make major concessions unless they know that they can bring their people behind, that the Arabs are behind them, and that they have the American guarantees behind them. And they want to know who's going to be in office. They don't know that now. And the same with the Israelis.
President Clinton made an enormous investment in this effort for a Middle East agreement at the end of his term in office. And I wonder, are there lessons, David, that the Bush administration has learned from President Clinton's experience?
Susan, they are, but the lessons keep changing. At the beginning of the administration, the lesson that they extracted from this, the beginning of the Bush administration, was we're not going to do what President Clinton did. We're not going to get the President of the United States deeply involved in shuttle diplomacy back and forth and having him sitting there counting settlements, you know, in the West Bank and so forth. What they discovered over time was that if you don't do that, you don't even begin to make any progress toward getting a meeting or a conference together. And so now you see Secretary Rice over acting much more in the tradition of past secretaries of state of trying to shuttle around and make this happen. But we haven't even heard for sure. Well, they haven't set a date for Annapolis yet, although we're all told it's the days after Thanksgiving, not that far away. Mm-hmm. We don't know who's coming. And that we also don't know whether President Bush is coming, even though it's only a 40-minute drive if the traffic is low between Washington and Annapolis.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to some callers who have been waiting. Sandra's calling us from Easton, Connecticut. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. Something that's been bothering me is that in Pakistan, once Musharraf turned the territories, the Northwest territories, over to the, call it traditional tribal sheikhs who were sort of in charge up there, Al-Qaeda began liquidating those same tribal leaders, so that now in at least two of those areas, Al-Qaeda's in charge, not the traditional way of resolving things, let's say. I never hear it mentioned, and I'm just wondering if anybody there has any thoughts on it and how it's going to affect what happens with Musharraf.
All right, Sandra, thanks for your call. Khalid Hassan, what do you think?
Well, number one, we don't know if Al-Qaeda is in charge. It's a very questionable assumption. And secondly, the fact is that history shows us, and it's a well-known thing, that they don't like foreigners there. And there are foreigners in Afghanistan. There are foreigners in the area. And as long as there is a foreign presence, there cannot be peace.
All right. Let's take another caller. We'll go to Dallas, Texas, and talk to Saeed. Hi, Saeed. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. My question is also, again, about Pakistan, that why Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto, they are not able to compromise on some basics, while they know that radicalism, Islamic radicalism in that country is against both of them. And why don't they look at Iran? I mean, Shah and Mossadegh, they were not able to compromise, and finally Khomeini came to power. I want to know why they're not able to compromise on some basics.
All right, Saeed, thanks for your call.
I think the situation in Pakistan cannot be compared with the situation in Iran at all. The fact is that if there is radicalism in Pakistan today, It is the Pakistani army which is responsible. It has failed to administer the country properly. And there is, in fact, there are elements within the Pakistani establishment which support these radical groups. And the Musharraf has been playing both sides of the street. He hasn't delivered. And the only chance that this situation can be remedied if there is a popular elected civilian government.
All right, Keith Richburg.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, Benazir Bhutto, I think, was trying to compromise with Musharraf, and I think she took some heat from her own party members and from Nawaz Sharif and others for negotiating with a dictatorship. But she was trying to because she said, Rayop, she told me, she told others that, look, you know, I think, you know, Islamic extremism is a problem here. The terrorist problem is a real threat. So I'm willing to dance with the devil here so we can jointly tackle that threat. And then he turned around and declared emergency rule and put her under house arrest. So I think you could say that there was no compromise on Musharraf's part.
Right. And now she said that she won't participate in this coalition kind of government. She's called for him to step down.
This is what puts the administration in a tough position because they very much engineered her return to Pakistan. So she arrives under these suspicions that Keith has mentioned. And suddenly discovers a vastly changed situation. So now the U.S. government is in the position of trying to broker a compromise with somebody who says they can't participate in this government anymore. And that's what makes it such a vexing choice for the U.S. Do they dump Musharraf and cast their lot back in an unpredictable democratic scene or not?
Will John Negroponte, the Deputy Secretary of State, meet with Benazir Bhutto while he's in Pakistan, do you think?
We don't know, but I suppose he will.
All right. Well, we're going to take another very short break, and we'll continue our conversation with David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent with The New York Times, Keith Richburg, Foreign Editor of The Washington Post, and Khalid Hassan, U.S. Correspondent for The Friday Times and Daily Times of Pakistan. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on in France. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, and by NPR stations, by Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs creating a greener tomorrow, on the web at kauffman.org. And by the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable, on the web at grdodge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Nixon and Kissinger, their collaborations and rivalries, backstabbing intrigues, and foul language. We talk with presidential historian Robert Dallek. His book about their partnership is now out in paperback. Dallek describes the two as co-presidents. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Khalid Hassan from the Friday Times and Daily Times of Pakistan, Keith Richburg of the Washington Post, David Sanger of the New York Times. Well, Thursday marked the second day of a transport worker strike in France. Why are they striking, Khalid?
Why do workers strike? I think they strike for better wages.
And not unusual in France to have these kind of strikes, but it is the response of the new president has been different from the man he succeeded in these kind of strikes. Tell us about that, Keith.
That's right. You know, Jacques Chirac came in office, vowing basically to do the exact same things that Sarkozy has vowed to do. The strike started. France was paralyzed. Basically, they called an election, and he lost. And he had to share power with the socialists for the remainder of his presidency. You know, Sarkozy is an interesting character. This could be his what they call his Margaret Thatcher moment. I mean, he got elected promising what he called a rupture, or a break with the past. Unions have incredible power in France, and it's also France has incredibly low productivity. What he's doing is it's a very modest reform that he's proposing now, and this is why they're on strike. But this is where they've drawn the line. And basically, what he's saying is that these public sector workers, transport workers, cannot retire after 37 years. They have to work 40 years. Now, that sounds like a pretty minor, and it won't even affect people on the edge of retirement right now. It sounds like a minor reform, but what they're doing is drawing a line and saying, you can't make these changes without negotiating with us, the unions. And he's saying, this has to be done. We've got to come up with a regime where a government can make these kind of decisions, and we can make France more productive. Now, next week, I think the other workers go on strike, other public sector workers. University students are already on strike. Gas and electrical workers are on strike. The trick is this government going to do what Chirac's government did, which is eventually negotiate and pull back on reform, in which case it just becomes another weak government that can't govern for the next several years? Or will he stick to it? Will this become his Margaret Thatcher moment? And we remember when Thatcher broke the miners' strike in Britain.
Well, I wonder, Nicolas Sarkozy did come into office, did campaign for office, saying this was the kind of thing he wanted to do. So I wonder if he's in a stronger position than his predecessors in terms of trying to break the strike.
He's in a stronger position at the outset of his presidency, as Keith suggests, if he has to back off, which may have to do more with, the government behind him than his own inclinations, he's going to have a problem. But what you're seeing here is a classic globalization argument. I mean, the French not only have found themselves competing more in a world economy, they find themselves competing in an increasingly competitive European Union economy. And so the pressures on France to give up many things that seem to be part of French tradition here are stronger than many places even elsewhere in Europe. And Sarkozy has basically taken a bet that the moment has come that he can change these habits. No one's quite sure.
Unemployment in France has been about 10% for nearly two decades, and they've seen places like Germany and Italy institute economic reforms that seem to have paid off. And I wonder if that's what they're watching, too.
I don't know. I think Sarkozy will have to really pull back, because it has been said that the worst enemy of a political party, are the promises it makes before getting into office. Once it gets into office, realizes that politics is the art of the possible, and he may have to pull back.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. Well, we had an emailer interested in talking about the situation involving Blackwater, the private security agency that's working for the State Department in Iraq. FBI investigators said this week that the killing of 14 Iraqi civilians by Blackwater was unjustified. What's going on with this investigation? David?
This has been a fascinating case. The FBI was brought in to go examine the conditions surrounding this incredible shootout, which was somewhat remarkable because until now, their investigations, if they have had any, of killings that happened by these private security firms were very cursory, and usually those involved were just sent back to the United States and there were no prosecutions and all that. Clearly, given what's going on around this one, the prospect of there being no prosecutions is, I think, fairly low. However, it may turn out that there is enough immunity for these workers based on rules that were put in place protecting the security companies during the American occupation under Jerry Bremer, that it may be very difficult to prosecute them no matter what the FBI concludes here.
How big an issue has this become in Iraq, Keith?
It's a huge issue, and I think it could be, when we look back and write the history of the Iraq war and occupation, it could be seen as a real turning point in the relations between the Iraqi government and the Americans. The Iraqis were furious. I mean, you know, these reports of wild cowboy, out-of-control security contractors have been going around for a long time. I mean, you talk to any Iraqi or talk to any American journalist, you know, who's had guns pointed at them from these, you know, fast-moving convoys whipping through the streets, and they will tell you these guys are cowboys. They're out of control. This shooting at the square, the Mansour Square in Baghdad, changed a lot because this was a relatively upscale neighborhood of Baghdad. These were people on their – these were middle-class people on their way to work. There were witnesses who saw it all, including Iraqi police, and it came at a point when the Iraqi government was in a mood saying we're not going to be pushed around anymore by these gun-waving Americans. There were absolutely no indications from any of the witnesses that there was any shooting at all at the Blackwater Guards, that they were just simply stuck in traffic. And it seemed to be that this was one case of an abuse gone too far.
And, of course, the death toll was so high in this particular case.
17.
We had another case this week where an Iraqi civilian in Baghdad shot and killed last Saturday by a guard from a different American private security company, DynCorp International. What about this case, Khalid?
The thing is that, you know, what shocks the Iraqi people is the impunity with which Blackwater has been operating. And, in fact, it has really done such a lot of damage to the image of the U.S., to the image of the U.S. troops, and all the good work, a lot of the good work which has been done. So as soon as the quicker these outfits, these cowboy outfits, are withdrawn and dealt with, the better.
Well, what are the prospects that Blackwater and these other private security companies will be withdrawn by the State Department from Iraq? Is that a prospect?
I think it's difficult, almost impossible, to withdraw them. The question is not withdrawing them, because they do serve functions that, if they weren't there, it would be tying down U.S. soldiers doing this. And I'm talking about guarding convoys coming in, guarding diplomats shuttling around. It's, you know, one of the largest, if not the largest, U.S. embassy in the world, and these diplomats have to go places and they need protection. And it's always been a question of who would control these guards, these private security guards. The Pentagon doesn't really want to get involved in it, mainly because they've got enough on their plate right now. They don't want to get involved in scheduling when a political officer is leaving a compound and going to a government ministry. They don't really want to get involved in that.
On the other hand, it's becoming increasingly clear they're going to have to, because you've also run into situations where you've had these security guards and these convoys flying through areas that were ostensibly under the control of American military, and they have no idea whether this flying wedge of gun-wielding guards that's coming down are our guys, private security, but ours, or not our guys, which could become a problem. And so it is really Wild West in that regard.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Paul. He's calling us from Tucson, Arizona. Paul, thank you for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
And thank you. My question or comment arcs back to the French transportation strike. What neither of the commentators noted was that the French transportation workers years ago in their contracts surrendered other benefits in exchange for early retirement. Now, years later, having not gotten those benefits, they're being asked to give up that which they bargained for, early retirement. Don't consider that to be fair. I'll take my comments, your comments or responses off the air.
Okay, Paul, thanks very much. Keith, what do you think?
Nobody ever said it was fair. the government's looking at it and saying, you know, we simply can't afford this. I mean, the government in France, you know, is depending on how you look at it, running deficits. They're running deficits that even the European Union is saying, look, it's outside of the ban that we allow. But they're looking, you know, they've got an economy that's sluggish. They've got 10% unemployment. It's been basically around 9-10% for decades. It hasn't budged. And the other problem is growth is being inhibited by these huge payouts that the government has to spend in terms of retirement. And among other things, they don't have a really large birth rate. So they don't have a large pool of workers to support this incredibly large pool of retirees. So yeah, it's not fair, but it's also not fair that the United Auto Workers in Detroit had to give up their health benefits or transfer, you know, health responsibility to the union from the auto workers. But, you know, struggling businesses always go back and renegotiate contracts, and struggling governments do too.
All right, let's go to Miami Beach, Florida, and talk to Mike. Mike, hi. Thanks for holding on.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment about the Blackwater killings. And that it's one thing when these private military corporations, like you said, are given a free rein with no legal authority over them, and, you know, four years down the road that the Iraqis want this to stop. But I also saw in the new Brian De Palma film, Redacted, that over 2,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed by the U.S. military at checkpoints, whereas only 60 of those 2,000 were ever found out to be insurgents at all. So I think there's a lot of resentment in Iraq based on the occupation itself. And when you add on top of that these lawless private corporate military types, it's just like one straw too many for them. And I'd like to hear your comments on that.
All right, Mike, thanks for your call. David Sanger.
You know, I'm not sure that the Iraqi population necessarily distinguishes between a private American group walking around with guns and American military walking around with guns. It is all part, as your caller suggested, of an occupation mentality. Now, if you ask the Bush administration, they'll tell you the occupation ended in 2004.
With the departure of
Bremer's authority and turning things over. But the fact of the matter is that the Iraqis can't take over right now for the security of their own country. So someone's got to do that. That someone's got to be us. And as Keith suggested, if that's the case, we have to decide whether or not our forces are better spent, you know, up working on Anbar and the sort of stated rules, or whether or not they're going to become glorified bodyguards.
All right, we have a caller who I think worked as a contractor in Iraq named Jeff. Jeff's calling us from Kent, Washington. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning. Now, you worked in Iraq yourself?
In 2004, yes, ma'am.
What were you doing there?
I was working part of a buildup with a small South Korean electrical engineer. We were protecting him while he was trying to redesign part of the engineering system, electrical grids there. And unfortunately, they used the term reconstruction when in actuality none of it existed in the first place. So my point for the commentators was certain elements of our government and the media keep pushing this ungoverned, unruled cowboy mentality but they don't mention things like they hire us themselves. They know that rarely are we in any sense out of control or willing to jump out of a vehicle, out of an armored vehicle, to try and engage quote-unquote innocent Iraqis. That puts us at risk. So it's like it's a story that doesn't make a lot of sense. Excuse me. Just running up the stairs.
So you think it's not fair, the portrayal of the private contractors here?
I think that ultimately the story has been segregated to being, you know, just something to draw people's attention instead of the reality. I know I handled security for one of the major news networks in New Orleans after Katrina, and ultimately everything went fine. Everything goes well on a regular basis, but the story still gets twisted out to try and make it seem impressive or threatening or dangerous, when reality is there's tens of thousands of us doing our job every day. It goes quiet, and incidents happen. If you stop in traffic, the immediate thing we do is step out of the vehicle, and we start scanning the perimeter, looking around us, and then something happens. You see a gun pointed at you. One guy calls it a gun. Next thing you know, there's things happening. That's just the reality of a combat zone.
All right, Jeff, that's very interesting. Thank you so much for getting your perspective. What would you all say to Jeff's point?
I would just say that, first of all, I would say he's right in one sense. There are tens of thousands of private contractors working there, and I'm sure the vast majority of them have probably never even fired their weapons. They're guarding, you know, journalists, they're guarding diplomats, et cetera. So we probably are talking about a small number of that overall number. But I think the problem comes in with the Iraqis, and the reason we report it is because when American soldiers get involved in these incidents, there's after-action reports. They have to go back and account for why they fired their weapons. Someone will go back and investigate the scene.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email that we've received. This writer, Keith, writes, Keith from Cleveland says, "Please step back and discuss the overall strategic situation surrounding Iraq. As we speak today, Turkey is threatening to invade the Kurdish area in northern Iraq. Iran has been emboldened and empowered now that we don't have the counterbalance of Iraq to worry about. Pakistan is enveloped in political crisis, and the Taliban and the radicals have gained strength in Afghanistan. Does that seem like a fair depiction of what sounds like an incredibly unsettled area, Khalid?
I think he sums it up very well. And I think the key lies in Iraq. I think Iraq should be left to the Iraqis. Let them manage it.
David Sanger, what do you make of this situation, the area of this whole region? Is it in much more turmoil than it was, say, at the point of the U.S. invasion in 2003?
It is, Susan, and you have to remember what the White House thought would happen after the invasion. First of all, the invasion was supposed to be a very quick event, and in fact, the fall of Saddam was quick. The part that they got wrong was what would happen after that. The theory was that the Iranians would be intimidated by the show of U.S. force, that the North Koreans would back down because they would have realized what happened to Saddam, that al-Qaeda and the Taliban would remain on the run and wouldn't use the time period to regain their foothold in the Northwest Territories and in Afghanistan. And in fact, the more we got bogged down, the more it empowered the rest of them.
Keith Richford, just a final word from you. Looking ahead, this unsettled situation in Iraq and Iran and Pakistan and Afghanistan, how long should we expect this to continue? For a new president, what's looking ahead? What do you see in the future?
I see a lot of crisis on the horizon for the new president to inherit, and there are going to be a lot of questions about how to get this thing back right again and fix it. Just a couple of points. You left off the Israel-Palestinian dispute and the Hamas takeover of Gaza, and you left off the crisis in Lebanon going on, where a pro-Western government is being threatened, politicians are being assassinated. You've got a lot of crises here, and you've got the Bush democracy agenda that he announced at the launch of his second term is basically in tatters. And I think of all of these, I think one of the ones we have to really look at is Afghanistan. That was the one that could have been a great success, but many people think we just took our eye off the ball there.
Keith Richburg, David Sanger, Khalid Hassan, thank you so much for being with us on the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.